Welcome to the second episode of the Wake Cast. My name is Sky Hopinka, and I am here with
Evan Gardner
and Susanna Ciotti.
Yeah, we've got a summer language intensive in Anchorage, Alaska, starting, we think, May 20th and going until August 5th, 2018. Mm-hmm. We'll be in an urban environment that we don't usually get to be in. So, you know, downtown Anchorage. Mm-hmm. And we'll be working with two dialects of Unangam Tenu, languages from Atka, Alaska, and St. Paul, St. George, Western Unangam Tenu and Eastern Unangam Tenu. So it's going to be great. We're going to actually run two languages simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time we've ever done that.
Yep.
We usually focus on one language, one dialect, one variety, but this year in Anchorage, we have two dialects, the two major dialects of Unangam Tenu, and because there's a lot of people in Anchorage who have moved in from the villages, a lot of the speakers live in Anchorage. A lot of the speakers live there, and some interested learners live there who haven't been able to participate in the village summer intensive that we've had on St. Paul and Atka.
Cool. So, I mean, I guess, do you want to give some background on what the summer languages, late summer language intensives are? Like where they started and why they started?
Well, we started doing summer language intensives in 2011. The first one was in Warm Springs, Oregon, and we worked with the Northern Paiute language. And we started it just because it seemed like the right thing to do, to sort of like focus everybody's energy on one language and try to increase the number of speakers, increase the number of teachers, and increase the number of lessons, and really just kind of like bring some attention to the language, that kind of some excitement, some focus. And so we needed a thing.
An event. To kind of build up to.
Mm-hmm. An excuse to get people together, really. Because yeah. It's kind of like, well, we could do something. It's like, oh, what do you want me to do? Or what should I do? And it's like, oh, well, call me when you have an idea. Sometimes I think people need a thing to go to. Mm-hmm. and a start place that I think sometimes if you just say, oh, well, just learn your language, it's kind of like, okay, well, I could do that anytime, so I'll never start. Because I could do it anytime. So if you have this thing that starts, we're going to do a thing, you want to be part of the thing, then it's like, okay, yeah, let's do it. When does it start? Okay, I'm going to arrange my schedule so that I'm free so that I can start. I'm like, yeah, that's when. So that's kind of how the summer intensive idea took off. And people often have summers off. So high school kids, I mean, they have the summer. Teachers have the summer, students have the summer, and sometimes there are projects that can happen during the summer because people are thinking about summer as a break, and so it's kind of a thing to fill that break. Even though a lot of times people are really busy during the summer, it's something to do.
Susanna, your first summer language intensive was with Unangam Tenu, am I right?
No, I came for the second half of the summer language intensive in 2014 that we did here in Vancouver, BC.
Right, that's
right. And then when we were when you were with us in 2015, that was my first full summer intensive in St. Paul.
So like, how have those changed for you, or like what are some things that you've seen changed over the course of like 2014 to the present, Susanna?
Wow, I feel like a lot has changed between 2014 and now. It's also just interesting because we've been, the last 3 years since 2014, we've been doing summer intensives with the same language family, like with Unangam Tenu, even though we've been divided between the dialects. So I think it's probably a different perspective maybe than Evan would have going back to like 2011 and how things have changed since then, not working on the same language. But as you know, and as people who are listening may know, Warrior Keys is constantly changing. We're always kind of soliciting feedback from the people who we work with the community members, interns, anyone that we engage with, we're always asking, well, how could we do this better? How could we be more effective? How could we make people more comfortable? How could we use our time better? And I definitely have seen a huge amount of that input go into each successive summer. So all of the input that we got in 2014, we turned around and tried to implement in 2015. We can't implement all of the changes. That's too much. But we do every year make a concerted effort to take the feedback that we get and try to change things. So we've definitely created some more kind of like organizational tools that we're using. And I think the kind of the house where the Where Your Keys house, where we've been staying every summer, has gotten more and more close to kind of the immersion house model that we're trying to set up, where we do a lot of color coding. And well, you could probably speak to that, Sky, like the difference between 2011 and 2014.
Yeah, I mean, like, I remember in 2011, like the first Where Your Keys summer language intensive, I mean, color coded bedrooms, dishes, plates, like everything was color coded. The towels mm-hmm. was like a black, green, red, and blue were the main colors. And I mean, it was just like, I was totally into it, you know, because it was a way to facilitate language and just to, you know, talk about which one is mine, which one's yours, incorporate color. I think the next summer language intensive that I went to was St. Paul in 2015. And it had like ramped up by 1,000%.
The color coding?
Like the color coding, the organization, like, I mean, it's really intense to like walk into that house for the first time and just see the level of organization, but also the level of care that goes into trying to make this as much of an immersive process as possible. Like not only immersive in the language, but in the idea of community building and, you know, participation in even just this house where it's like making dinner, making breakfast, or getting on a schedule, or just, you know, figuring out how to do downtime. It's like really regimented, but not in a rigid way. From what I've seen from 2011, where just like the ride cards were being figured out, like how do we make this into a curriculum, or like what's the deliverable to a community at the end of a summer? You know, it's nice to see like the trajectory of this method and the possibility of it coming into fruition in different ways. And I know that, Susanna, you had a lot to do with that.
Yeah.
It was definitely.
Absolutely.
Yes. I mean, I've seen plenty of Evan drawings.
What are you trying to say, Scott? Plenty of indistinguishable Evan drawings.
They're beautiful.
They're beautiful as like interpretive art, but they're not beautiful in terms of like communicative tools.
That goes into like how do you prepare an intern for entering not only this community, but also this house?
I don't think people know, and I'm glad we're talking about it now, because I don't think people know like you said, Sky, when you walk into the house, you're like, okay, I'm walking into a thing. Like this, something's going on. And I definitely think it takes people a couple of days to realize sort of what they've walked into. Mm-hmm. And we try to explain that that's what's happening. We try to say we're you know, trying to be as organized as possible. Everything's color-coded. There's a schedule, you know, because we have only been able to stay in places with one bathroom. There's like 5 people in one bathroom, so we need a bathroom schedule. And it's like they're walking into a roommate situation, but some people haven't had 5 roommates in one bathroom before.
Or not in a while.
Yeah, right. It's been a while since that's happened. And sort of coupled with the idea of like, oh, I can't really move out. So there, you know, like kind of when you show up for the summer, there's this kind of feeling of like, oh, I'm in this and I'm in it. And so we try to prepare people for that feeling, but I think that sometimes people don't necessarily believe that we're serious, because mm-hmm. I don't think that people really think about language revitalization as this highly organized, very thought out process. And I think that that's something that we are really trying to bring to the idea of language revitalization, is this, like, you can do a lot to create an environment where people feel included and where there's a really active schedule for trying to create the most productive environment that you can, not only language production, but also for community development. And what we're trying to show people is that these are not random. This is a thing you can learn how to do, and you can show people how to do, and you can duplicate this after we're gone. And so I think that preparing the interns to walk into that, to really understand that they're going to be part of this, it's kind of difficult to get somebody ready for that, but at the same time, it's really part of what we do when we find somebody who we have asked to come with us, and then we set up a series of entrance trainings. Mm-hmm. So we set up, I don't know, last year I think we had seven mm-hmm. Pre-trip meetings where we talk about all kinds of stuff, like the house. Mm-hmm. Hey, by the way, you are going to have 5 roommates. Mm-hmm. What do you like to eat? What do you... We sent out a questionnaire last year that Susanna put together. It's a beautiful questionnaire about, like, what are your favorite jams?
Right.
You know, what jams do you hate? And we don't buy those jams. Well, we buy the ones that people like. Mm-hmm. But we definitely overbought a couple of things last year.
A lot of pineapple.
Where one of the interns said, like, I love pineapple. I love, love, love pineapple. So I was in different stores throughout Seattle.
Yeah.
Like, because we had to put everything on a barge to send it out to St. Paul. And so I was going to all different stores buying all kinds of, like, different types of pineapple. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you wouldn't think that there are that many. But and then we got there and he was like, oh, well, I mean, pineapple's okay. And I was like, you are going to love pineapple. You are going to love pineapple like you've never loved pineapple before. And I think it was funny because I don't think that they expected that we were going to like take those menu suggestions as seriously as we did. Mm-hmm. But that's really, I think, what is the most difficult thing, I think, about prepping a community for a summer language intensive, and also prepping the interns for a summer language intensive, is this idea, like, we are really going to bring a thing. Mm-hmm. And a thing is about to happen, so really be ready for it, because it's coming. I think that's the most difficult thing to really prepare people for, is the reality of, like, we're going to do this, and it's a flash mob.
Yeah.
Of people.
Yeah. Language flash mob.
So I think that's the most difficult thing.
In terms of preparing people for what to expect?
Yeah. I mean, well, I don't even know if you asked what the most difficult thing was, but that's where I ended up.
How do you prepare? Yeah. How do you prepare people? Yeah. I mean, I think what you said, Sky, too, is really accurate in that, like, you walk into the house, it's kind of intense. Like, it is an intensive. We call it that for a reason.
Just lots of tiny animals everywhere.
Lots of tiny animals
what
everywhere.
What am I going to do with this thing?
Lots of props for learning language. But also, we definitely have, I think it is totally comparable to any kind of, like, immersion language situation, even though we're not doing immersion language typically at the house. We're just immersed in the business of language revitalization. Business theory, ideas about, so it's we're kind of talking about that all of the time. We do our best to make sure that people know that before they sign up, and we do have a bunch of posts up on the Where Your Keys blog right now that sort of have, like, schedule ideas and expectations. And one of our interns from last summer, Mary, wrote a really nice blog post about sort of, like, a day in the life of an intern. So people who are interested should go check those out. We do try to be as transparent as possible and upfront as possible about what people should expect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like, it's just having, like, all those props and, like, just the house, the way it's set up. I mean, I was just thinking about, like, how people would have, like, signs around their house on furniture of, like, what the word and the target language is for that object. You know, it's mm-hmm. a way to engage with it, or to think about, oh, yeah, that's a microwave, it's a coffee maker, it's a chair. But then when you have objects like color-coded, or just like the house is designed to be a place for language to happen, then you start to realize that all these different objects are opportunities for engaging with the language, which addresses, like, a really big problem. Your capabilities in the language reach a certain point where it's like, well, what do I do now? Where do I go from here? Where is it just me and my friends? Or, like, how can I actually incorporate this language into my everyday life and continue that model without it just being either, like, a classroom thing or just a Wednesday night thing or a Saturday night thing or whatever it is that your language group has to offer for keeping the language going.
And I think that that's what we're really trying to model at the Where Your Keys house is, well, this is how you could set that up.
Mm-hmm.
now do everything we did, now just don't do it in English.
Mm-hmm.
And we just don't often have the fluency. And we're really not trying to, we try to be really upfront with this when we are recruiting interns, is that we want everyone to know that we're not actually going to do an immersion summer at the Warrior Keys house.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're going to be talking a lot about pedagogical theory and how did you do today and
best practices
and all that kind of stuff. And we need to talk about that in English because we're trying to have as great of impact as we can during our work hours. Mm-hmm. So we're bringing a lot of that home. And this is really kind of an incredible chance for people to really have an in-depth conversation about language revitalization.
Mm-hmm.
So it's part of the planning, and the discussions that we have beforehand are we're going to have these conversations in English at the house. You could use this same structure if you're going to create an immersion house, which we hope you do. I think that part of the process of getting someone ready for a summer too is how we are recruiting people. We're really trying to find people that are really passionate about language revitalization.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to find people who are already hopefully working with a language. Maybe it's a language of their own language. We're actively trying to find people who are sort of these language champions or want to be involved with their home language and bring them to another group.
So that relates to a broader question that I have, which is, why bring, I guess there's two parts to this question. Why bring interns from an outside community to St. Paul or to Anchorage or to another community? Why bring non-Indigenous people to the Summer Language Intensive? And how does that relate to the overall experience, or just, you know, what's some of the reasoning? Or because, like, it is a question that's been asked, and it's an important question to address, especially considering, like, where Language Revitalization Act is with Indigenous communities. And what are some of your thoughts on that?
I guess we'll talk generally first about why we encourage bringing outsiders to a community, whether they're Indigenous or non-Indigenous. As Evan is saying, it's definitely, in our experience, we found that people can come into a community as an outsider and the stakes are relatively low for them, maybe compared to someone who's a learner within the community who might have to sit with a relative, their grandma, their grandpa, their aunt, their uncle, to learn the language. And I think that there's definitely a lot of emotions that go with that. And it's, you know, mistakes are scary and you don't want to disappoint people. So the kind of emotional stakes can be pretty high. Outsiders who come in, obviously they care strongly about the success of the project, the program, and the learners within the community. But because they have fewer strong emotional ties to the people, like they're not related to people, and they're interested in the language, but it's not their own heritage language, they have a little bit lower stakes. They can be a little bit more relaxed, and that we have found really influences the team as a whole, including the local team members. It helps them sort of like see people make mistakes and then recover from them and then be like, oh yeah, you know, just shake it off. It wasn't that big of a deal.
Hey, that's a technique, other people's dishes.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. It's much easier to do someone else's dishes or clean out someone else's closet when it's then your own. It's much harder when you have to like sort through your own stuff. Yeah.
No emotional attachment.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a big reason why we bring in outsiders. And we've gotten very positive feedback from communities in recent years about having outsiders in and how helpful it is. Even people who are sort of like, you know, at the beginning, unsure of how that would play out, people had a super positive reaction to it.
And I think that it kind of goes both ways. We get this question from applicants as well, in prospective interns. They will often say, well, like, why are you bringing outsiders?
Mm-hmm.
But we're always looking for the host community to be a part of that. Like, we're not coming in and saying like, oh well, this is going to be the thing that happens here. It's always a cooperation and a collaboration. So it's a really valid question for interns to ask, and for the host community, it's we give them the same answer,
mm-hmm.
that it's people who are going to come in and who are going to really as like kind of like models for risk taking,
mm-hmm.
in the language, like, I'm going to take some risks and it's going to be okay, everybody. Take some risks with me.
And support. I think if the emotional stakes are high for everyone, it's really hard to support each other. I mean, it certainly can be done, but it takes a bigger toll on people. And I think if you have people there who are, you know, there to help the local learners, you know, get as far as they can in a summer and, you know, be successful. And if they have certain goals they want to achieve or things that they are anxious about, like, you know, teaching a class for the first time, teaching a lesson for the first time, running plus deltas for the first time, that there are people there to support them through that.
I guess like how I think about it is finding a way to unlearn a lot of the bad language habits that we learned in high school or learned through the process of trying to figure things out.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, you know, it is about having to pronounce everything just right or memorizing everything and being tested on that. And, you know, just the general way that language is taught in this country is just really detrimental to a lot of, I don't know, positive feelings around learning language. And like having different people there like really helps with a safety net or a community, or just like another example of like what you guys were saying, you know, how to think about language in another way through another's eyes in terms of just people visiting or just having visitors rather than outsiders, you know.
Yeah.
Having guests, and like how do you share your language with a guest, and how important it is to think about it in that terms when for so long, like, Native people have had to keep their languages either secret or private or really close to their hearts so that it doesn't get lost. Or
yeah, and I think that it's really important. And I think we'll just kind of mention this over and over again throughout this podcast, throughout the podcast in the future. I want everyone to know that we are very, very aware of the history that languages have gone through and are going through. And it's going to take a lot to reverse the trend. But what we're really trying to focus on is what we can do, but understanding that there is absolutely history that I think that we've been really lucky to learn. And I think that that's a thing that part of, I think that this kind of goes into the sort of part B of the question that you asked earlier was, what about bringing in guests, outsiders, visitors? And the next piece of that is like, Indigenous or non-Indigenous. Mm-hmm. I think that this is a real important idea for non-Indigenous people to actually live and experience what that history is doing and how they can be a part of changing the future of it, how they can have some kind of impact on it. The other thing about bringing non-Indigenous people to an Indigenous community to assist with language revitalization is that I think that there's a lot of education that non-Indigenous people need around the history of
colonization.
Yeah. I mean, fill in every blank that can possibly be that pause there. Mm-hmm. I don't even know how to wrap my mind around that. Mm-hmm. That is a thing that just does not get talked about. And to be able to talk about it a little bit and then say, okay, what's our lesson going to be today? So that we can kind of push through it and try to figure out how we're going to not just get stuck in that, but create more fluent speakers who can move through that healing in a more positive way. And that's really part of what we're doing when we look for interns, is that we're trying to find people who are interested in that education. Like, we're not looking for people who aren't interested in that. There are plenty of people who are. So that's really who we're looking for.
Just one more piece of that, of bringing people who are not Indigenous, is that usually, I mean, we hope to bring both people who are Indigenous and not Indigenous to work who are both outsiders. But we definitely know that if we bring someone with us who is Indigenous and who is working on their own heritage language, it's likely that we won't get them for a lot of additional summers. We may get them for like a couple of summers here and there, but that person is also probably like extremely valuable to their home community, and it's hard to pull them away kind of over and over and over again. So if we have a good variety of people, we know that some of the non-Indigenous people we're bringing, we're not really pulling away from a community unless they're partnering already with a community, in which case they're kind of in the same situation, that they'll go back and bring the stuff that they've experienced over the summer to try to help support the community that they're working with. But definitely, we don't want to drain from one community to help another community. We want to make sure that we have some people who don't have as many ties and are a little bit more free to move around to a bunch of different communities.
Mm-hmm. I think that was my question of the week about that. But semi-related, But
wait, did you just ask it?
Yeah,
I think we just answered it first.
It was about the you know, like, why outsiders? Why guests? Why visitors?
Yeah.
But my technique of the week,
ooh,
is go there first.
Mm. Oh wow, that's a good one.
That is a good one.
I haven't talked about that one for a while. go there first.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll talk about what I know about that technique. But I don't know if it's. I will ask for more clarity in a moment. Right. But go there first is also tied to technique overdo it, which is I kind of explain technique overdo it and then back to go there first. So technique overdo it is when you are in a language learning or teaching scenario, you want to bring as much energy as you can to that moment. And so a lot of times you have to overdo it. So
without being annoying.
Well, yes. There is a fine, very fine line, which it's I often step, leap, jump,
fast,
pull vault over.
Yeah.
looking for it. But I think it's that trying to be exciting, kind of like what you do when a mom talks to a little kid. You know, a little kid comes in like, oh, did you fall down? You did. You know, and they're really sort of like overexcited about it to really help the emotional state maybe of the kid to get through that moment of like, oh, I fell down and I'm hurt. You know, they're like, oh, you fell down. Wow, you fell down so good. But not in like, I don't mean to say this like in a, you know, belittling kind of way. Mm-hmm. But sometimes when you're in the language lesson, you might say like, oh, is that a pen? Whose pen is that?
It's my pen.
Wow, that's Susanna's pen. Everybody, whose pen is that? That's Susanna's pen, right? You want to bring an extra emotion to it. So, because if you start out the lesson with like, is that a pen?
Yeah.
Great. I mean, everybody's already asleep. Sorry about that. So you want to like overdo the emotion to it. Go there first is, you want to be willing to try the lesson first. You want to be like the first one to raise your hand. You want to, if somebody says, you know, who wants to try, I don't know, seal oil? I'm like, yeah, me, right here. Send it my way. And so then I think that sets an example for other people that we're really trying to take risks. We're trying to take risks in language. We're trying to take risks in culture. We're trying to take risks in, and I don't mean like inappropriate risks. So kind of like what you said, Sky, about like annoying, but there's also like, yeah, I want to try that. But then also being willing to sort of set the expectation that we're going to take risks and we're going to be wrong and we're going to fail. And isn't it awesome? But at the same time, and this is also kind of loops back to what you were asking before about like, who we're looking for interns and like how we're preparing people to be an intern is we want people that are going to go there first. We want people that are going to raise their hand and be like, yeah, I want to try that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I remember when you first explained it to me, it was in terms of how fascinating. And you said that no one is going to put their hands higher than yours. And it's like that sets the tone for the room. Like when you do technique, obviously, if you do like a really over affected Valley Girl voice and hand gestures, yeah, they'll go almost just as far as you, but they won't ever do anything more. So you need to go there for us to set that example as far as the comfort level, but also just the exuberance that is often required for talking to people or just like teaching language.
Yeah, and I think that there's a fine line between entertainment and education. And if we're really trying to train people how to teach, part of that is go there first. Overdo it. Be ready to take a risk. Be ready to fail. And really be ready to be looked at, mm-hmm. I think, is part of the issue. Like, be ready to sort of be on stage as the entertainer, but with a purpose. You're not just, like, tap dancing for a show. You're like, I'm really going to do this in front of people. And then when people start looking at you as a teacher, you're kind of like, wow, I'm in front of people. And I think that that's really part of helping people to start to think about the role of being a teacher and being a little bit in the spotlight, and hopefully in a really positive but not too spotlighty kind of way, that we're hoping that it's a really gentle acknowledgement, I think, of a person starting to do something in their career or their journey as a language learner.
Or teacher. I mean, like, I am not the most outgoing person by any means. But, I mean, just like that sort of permission to be performative, or permission to, you know, just let loose a little bit for the language, really helped me think about how I don't have to be really self-conscious, or I don't have to like be really worried about my performance as a teacher, or am I doing things right, or what if I mess up, you know? And like, very much like how fascinating in a nutshell, but it's a way to get to how fascinating.
Yeah, I think you guys summed it up really great. I think about Go There First all of the time. I mean, I think it's really helpful for making your setups obvious if you have to have some kind of emotion. I'm thinking about, we just recently did our setup for the Go Fish game that we've been working on in a couple of communities. In the beginning, you have to offer people a whole bunch of items. You got to be like, ooh, which one of these do you want? Oh. And if you don't, if you're just like, which one do you want? Ooh. People are not going to understand. People are going to want to translate. And so, but if you kind of...
And they're going to want to leave.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they're bored.
But, and if the very first time they hear it, they see that, they're going to be like, oh, I get what's going on. And then when you send that language around your circle, they're going to all kind of chime in, and they'll get the joke of like, we're being a little bit ridiculous about it, but it's for the language. And there's a lot of stuff that we do that is in the interest of the language that maybe you wouldn't do in your normal everyday life.
Well, and I think that's a really good point too, because I think that a lot of times the techniques become this sort of armor that we get to put on, or even like an excuse for doing something. So you can say like, look, normally in my normal life, I am not an extrovert. But when I'm teaching, I realize that sometimes I do need to go there first, or I need to overdo it. So I might even say, hey, everybody, this is technique overdo it. I'm overdoing it here. And then it sort of gives you permission to overdo it. It's a funny kind of feedback loop, but everybody feels more comfortable because you've sort of said, oh, no, it's not me. It's I'm doing this. I'm doing a technique. Blame the technique. Don't blame me for overdoing it. But you should overdo it too, because it's a lot of fun. But I'm not judging you. It's technique overdo it. Mm-hmm. And it's a nice sort of deflection.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's about all that I have this week for my technique of the week and my question of the week.
That was a good one.
I do have an interesting topic for our next podcast. I don't know if I should tell you now or tell you later.
I feel like we should tease it.
Tease it.
Yeah. Teaser, the trailer for the next podcast. Unless you want to keep it a secret. It's okay.
I would suggest listening to some fresh air between now and then on NPR.
Okay. Mm. All right. On our next show. I'll talk with Sky Hopinka about our next show.
Thank you both for doing this again, but we do have a few announcements. Susanna?
We did talk a lot about the Summer Language Intensive that's coming up this summer 2018 in Anchorage, Alaska. There's a lot of information on our website. The website is whereareyourkeys.org.
And we look forward to talking with people, hearing from people.
So we're on Twitter at PlayWake and Instagram at PlayWake. And if you have any kind of question that you want to put out there for perhaps us to touch on in a future podcast, we established the hashtag WakeCastQuestion. So you can...
Does that have a question mark at the end of it?
No. Those don't go into hashtags, I don't think. So you could tweet at us with the hashtag WakeCastQuestion. You could also email podcast@whereareyourkeys.org.
Great. Thank you. I'll talk to you guys soon.
Yeah, great. Thanks. Those are great questions, Sky. Really good technique of the week. Haven't heard that one in a while.
Yeah.
And look forward to our next chat.
Till the next week, cast.
Maskey.
Maskey.